Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101, Section 1 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 12, delivered on March 1, 2012. The title of this lecture is Cost Structure of the Firm.
Today, Cost Structure of the Firm. I went through the three basic cost considerations, total cost, variable cost, and fixed cost in the last lecture. And then today I fill in the fourth of those curves, which is actually the most important of the curves that you can consider. But there was the average total cost. Well, let me write the original formulas, the three formulas. Total cost is variable cost plus fixed cost. And then if you divide everything by quantity, total cost over quantity is variable cost over quantity plus fixed cost over quantity. Now, that is another way of saying average total cost over quantity, is average variable cost over quantity, plus fixed cost over quantity. Yeah, AFC, I'm just trying to think of something that... Now, these three curves right here are, as I said, three of the four crucial cost considerations of a firm. And I'm trying to think how I want to put this. That last lecture I gave you, where I talked about an input factor, in the short run, we allow one factor to vary, and usually we say it's labor, against total productivity, total product, in other words, total output, has a shape something like this. It rises at a diminishing rate. That's the law of diminishing marginal productivity. The law of diminishing marginal productivity. That has a serious implication in cost. Let me write down that table that I had done before and show you something that's a consequence of that diminishing marginal productivity. I had the amount of labor going in and the total product coming out. Zero, and I want 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. We went from zero productivity. One worker brought us 100 units. Two brought 190. Three brought 270. Four brought 340. Five brought 400. Six brought 450. Seven brought 490. Eight brought 520. Nine brought 540. 10 workers brought in 550. 11 brought in 550, and then you actually got negative productivity with the 12th worker. And then from that, we had the marginal product of labor, how much each extra worker, each additional worker was contributing. The first worker contributed an extra 100 units. The second worker contributed an extra 90. Third worker, an extra 80. Fourth worker, an extra 70. Fifth worker, an extra 60 units were brought out of the field. Sixth The sixth worker brought an extra 50 units out of the field. Seventh worker brought an extra 40 units out of the field. And then eight was 30. Nine was 20. The 10th worker brought 10. The 11th worker brought nothing extra out of the field. And the 12th worker, we ended up actually losing some of our product there. And that, I just wanted to get that table up to bring up the next important point. A consequence of the law of diminishing marginal productivity is this. So how is it these workers, you're paying the same amount per worker, the same amount of wage per worker? You probably have to do that. I mean, it seemed reasonable. You can't tell the 10th worker he doesn't make as much as the 9th worker. So let's say that we're paying each of these workers, let's say $10 a day. That sounds like a fair wage in a good capitalist system. $10 a day. Now, let me look at the extra cost per unit of output. This is the extra cost. So now that first worker, he brought out 100 units and it cost me $10. So the extra cost for that first worker, would be, okay, an extra 100 units he brought out and it cost me $10 to bring those out. So I'd have $10 divided by 100 units. So the cost of that first worker's output would be, for 100 units, would be 10 cents per unit, 10 cents per tomato that he brought out of the field. Now, the second worker brought out 90 extra units. I had to pay him $10. He brought out 90 extra units. So I paid $10 divided by 90 units for his work coming out of the field. Now, if you take 10 divided by 90, that means that those tomatoes cost me 11 cents per unit to get those 90 extra tomatoes out of the field. Now, I'm going to bring out my calculator because I'm not going to even try to do even simple arithmetic in my head at this time of the morning. And so now let's go to the third worker. Well, I got 80 tomatoes out of the field from that third worker. I paid him $10 to get those 80 tomatoes. So those 80 tomatoes from him cost me $10 divided by 80, those cost me 12.5 cents per tomato per unit of output. Well, something interesting is going on here. If you watch this, I keep going. The fourth worker, if I had to pay him $10, I got 70 extra units out of the field from him, but that would mean 10 divided by 70. Those 70 units cost me a little more than 14 cents per unit. Now that fifth worker brought out 60 units, I had to pay $10 to get those 60 extra units from him. So that would be almost 17 cents a unit for each tomato. Now, we keep going with this. With that sixth worker, I'd have to pay him $10 at least $10. I might have to pay more if there's a shortage of these workers. I might have to ramp it up, but at best, I'll pay them $10 to bring out 50 units. So I've got my cost per unit for those 50 tomatoes is going to run an average of 20 cents a unit. And if I go down to this worker, 40 units came out of the field. I paid $10 to get 40 units. The cost of those 40 tomatoes has gone to 25 cents per tomato on average for those 40 tomatoes. By the time I get to the eighth worker, he's brought out 30 tomatoes. I paid him $10 to do that. So I'm paying, for those 30 tomatoes, I'm paying an average of 33 cents a unit per tomato. Get to the ninth worker who brought out only 20 tomatoes. $10 divided by 20 units, that means that I paid for those 20 tomatoes 50 cents on average per tomato. By the time I get to this tenth worker, he brought 10 tomatoes, an extra 10 tomatoes. I paid him $10 to do that. So those tomatoes cost me a dollar on average a piece for him to bring out of the field. And that is all simply, look what's happening to the extra cost, the marginal cost, the cost of the last tomato is skyrocketing. And it's all because of the law of diminishing marginal productivity, which is a law of nature. So this extra cost per unit is being driven by something that is not in the business's control. The law of diminishing marginal productivity will happen. And if you pay the workers, every extra worker, the same, which is the best case scenario, you might have to pay more to get some more workers, you're going to have an escalating marginal cost. And I'm just, as a freehand exercise, just sort of freehanding it, the marginal cost curve must look like a upward sloping, rapidly upward sloping curve. That's the big important curve in business, the cost of the last unit that is produced. And that will always be rising. So as a consequence of the law of diminishing marginal productivity is the law of increasing marginal cost. The last unit will cost more. The last unit produced will cost more than the unit before it did. It just will. This is what will drive our decision making, whether we're going to produce an extra unit, is how much that extra unit's going to cost us. Because if you have a price that you can charge, well, if the last unit, let's say there's 100 units, you could sell 100 units. The 100th unit costs, let's say your last tomato, the price of tomatoes is, let's say, 72 cents. You can actually sell tomatoes for 72 cents per tomato. If I were to look at this, I wouldn't make I wouldn't hire that 10th worker. I wouldn't do it because it cost me a dollar to get tomatoes out of the field at that level. I can sell them for only 72 cents. I would never go there. I would stop with 9 workers making 540, pulling 540 tomatoes out of the field because I was still, the cost of the last tomato was less than what I could sell it for. Why would I sell more? Why would I sell a tomato that cost me more to pull out of the field than I could get for it? That marginal cost, how much extra that last tomato costs me versus how much I can sell that last tomato for, drives my profit maximizing decision. I won't make something that costs me more to make than I can sell it for. I just won't do it. And if this law of diminishing marginal cost is driving my decision making, which it will, I'm going to stop when it costs me more, at the point where it costs me more to make the last unit than I can sell it for. That's why this law of increasing marginal cost is so important, and that's why it's the marginal cost curve, not the average curves. It's the marginal cost curve that drives my decision making in a business. I actually start losing profit. If I tried to bring out those last 10 tomatoes, see, they cost me a dollar each. If I can sell it for 72 cents, I'm losing on average, what, a 28 cents a unit trying to sell those. I just can't do it. That's why we will see, subsequent to the exam, that the entirety of decision-making in business is based not on averages at all. It's based upon the marginal, the cost of the last unit. And we get and if you were going to the business subjects over at the university or almost any place, you'll see that in production decision-making, we actually want to know what the cost of the last unit we make is. We don't just keep making and making because we can't just keep escalating our price that we sell them for. Sooner or later, the cost of the last unit is going to go higher than it's worth it for us to make that unit based on the price that we can charge for it. So now, this sets up, by the way, there's a practical use for you on this too, because by the end of this lecture, you're going to see how to answer 4 questions on the exam like a boss. They are so easy to answer. You'll see that at the end of this lecture. As a matter of fact, I'll even tell you what the questions are. You will get 4 questions right. That's 2 points each. You'll get at least 8 points on exam 1. You will not go home empty-handed. But I got to do something first here. It's a concept that has driven economic students crazy since time immemorial. And there are all kinds of ways to show this principle that's going on here. Is there like... Anyway. Excuse me. What the hell, man? You know? Are there like giants on this floor or something?
What?
You hear the boom, boom. I mean, so it's not just me and the funny pharmaceuticals I used to take.
I think it's the wind maybe in the vents up above.
Oh, okay. Well, that's kind of troubling in itself. Thank you. No, I've always, some years back, they put in these stupid phones in the classrooms, okay? Well, that was one thing. Then they announced these fire drills. They have a fire drill every semester. Well, the semester that they put the phones in, they had their fire drill. You know, fire drills are going, everyone's supposed to evacuate, the phone rings. I thought, well, that's weird. So I go over and answer it. This is a fire drill. Please evacuate the... You asshole, if that had been a fire, I'm burning up. I'm going to burn to death because I'm answering your phone instead of leaving the classroom. Yeah, anyway. Where the hell was I? Ah, I know. I was talking economics. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to draw some graphics graphical stuff on the board. There's no precision involved. It's sort of an illustration of an important concept in economics that has actually nothing whatsoever to do with economics at all. It's just it's an arithmetic principle, but when it goes into economics, it looks like something deep and very difficult to understand, but it's actually just a simple arithmetic thing that's actually kind of obvious. It starts with this class, and I've given the first exam to the students in this class. And the exam is all scored, and I add up the scores, and I divide by the number of students, okay? And I get an average. I get an average. And let's say that the average on the exam is a 70. And I'm going to draw a 70% on a vertical axis, just kind of without any markings on it, just up here a little ways, a 70 with a blue mark. That's the average on the exam, okay? Well, I'm happy, everyone's happy, except those who didn't pass. And I'm about to go on to new material, and someone stops and comes to the class and says, I just registered for this course. You can't register for this, but I did. Why? And I need to take the first exam. You have to take the first exam? Oh, okay, well, yes, I've been studying the materials, but I'm ready for it. Okay, well, where did you go to school? Oh, I went to high school in Decatur. Uh-oh. I've got to stop making fun of Decatur. My mom's from Decatur. Yes, I know, son. I see her in the parking lot at the truck stop. But, sorry. Okay, so he takes the exam, and he gets a 55%, which is pretty good for someone from Decatur. I knew it. Someone from Decatur. I shouldn't do that. The police are very nice there. They're very courteous when they arrest me. Okay, 55 on the exam. Okay, well, I'm going to have to calculate the average again. So I'm going to throw this 55 into the mix, add them up, and then divide by the number of students. Well, will the average be, what will happen to the average?
It'll pull it down.
Well, yeah, it's going to pull it down. I mean, that's obvious. If I have an average and then I throw a lower score into it, that's going to pull the average down. So now the average, let's say, has dropped down, say to, 66. Okay. Well, that's over with. That was a little weird. All of a sudden, here comes another student. I need to take the exam. What? Yeah, I just registered for the course. Oh, good heavens. Where did you come from? Where did you go to school? Morton. Oh, dear. Okay, well, this student from Morton takes the exam and pulls a 60%. Oh, well, I'm going to have to figure out the average again. Well, I throw a 60 into a pile that had an average of 66, then it will certainly pull the average down a little bit, right? I mean, you throw that in there. So, well, that draws the average down. Let's say it pulls it down to a 64. Here comes someone else. Okay, well, where did you go to school? I went to school at Normal Community West. Oh, well. Yeah. So this student takes the exam and gets a score of 64. Now, what's going to happen to the average if the average was 64? I put a 64 in and recalculate the average. What will happen to the average? Yeah, it's still going to be 64. That's just kind of common sense. Okay. Well, that was interesting. Well, now I've got one. Another student shows up. Well, where did you go to school? I went to school at U-High. Uh-oh. That student takes the exam and scores. Oh, let's say that student scores a 75 on the exam. What's going to happen to the average when I put a 75 into a pile that had an average of 64? You're going to be happy with the curve that happens after that? Someone who scores a 75, yeah, that's going to hurt the average that you guys had. Put this a little bit higher. The average is going to come up because throwing a 75 into a pile that had an average of 64 is going to pull the average up. Let's say it pulls it up to 68. Finally, one last student shows up. I need to take the exam. Okay, well, where did you go to school? I went to school at a Catholic school here. Oh, which one? Yeah, Our Lady of Perpetual Undulations. Oh, well, that's nice. That student scores an 85. Oh, let's say an 84. Well, the average was a 68. Throw an 84 in there. That's going to pull the average up. Maybe to 74 or something like that. Doesn't really matter. It's definitely going to pull the average up. Now let me draw in. The blue dots were an average curve. In this case, an average test score curve. The red dots were a marginal curve, the last score that was added. Now, if you look at what's going on there, it's just a simple arithmetic principle. When the marginal is below the average, when the last is below the average, when the last is below the average, the average is falling. See it? But when the last is above the average, the average is rising. The average is rising. And this doesn't matter whether it's test scores or costs or whatever. Whenever you have the last one thrown into a pile, it will cause the average to go down if the last is lower than the pile. And it will cause the average to go up if the last is above the average of the pile. What that means is also something right here. The average bottoms out when the last equals the average. When the last equals the average. Well, that's just the consequence of these two right here. When the last is below the average, it draws the average down. When the last is above the average, it pulls the average back up. Doesn't matter whether it's test scores or costs or whatever. That's just an arithmetic thing. And so as a consequence of those two things, the bottoming out of the curve happened right when the two were the same. Yeah, if the last one is the same as the average, it doesn't change the average. Here's the upshot of that for economics. And again, this is not an economics principle at all, though. First things first, let me write that one equation that I had before. Average total cost is average variable cost plus average fixed cost. I'm going to write that equation on the board, the last of those three that I did last time and started this lecture with. Let's talk about what the cost curves actually look like now. And I'm going to draw on the horizontal axis output level of the firm, and on the vertical axis a dollar sign representing cost. It can also be your price and all that. It's just a dollar amount of money. Okay, so now I'm going to need to deal with these three curves, the AFC, AVC, and ATC curves, but I also want to put in the marginal cost curve eventually. Now, the one that is kind of like the average, the odd man out is the average fixed cost curve. Now, remember that average fixed cost is your total cost, your fixed cost, which is a dollar amount of money divided by the output level. So whatever FC is, it's a number that won't change, which means that at an output level of 0, it would be infinite. At an output level of 1, FC, the average fixed cost would be the fixed cost divided by 1. As I increase the Q, the output level, going along the horizontal axis, AFC would have to be falling because I'd be dividing the same number by a larger and larger number. Like if your fixed cost was $100, for one unit it'd be $100, for two units $50, three go up to 10 units it'd be $10, 100 units it'd be $1, 1,000 units 10 cents. The average fixed cost curve is essentially what in arithmetic or in math, algebra actually, would be called the right branch of a rectangular hyperbola. In other words, it will never actually get to 0, no matter how big your Q is, but it will just keep getting less and less significant. Like when my fixed costs are, let's say, $1,000, and I'm producing one unit, my average fixed cost is $1,000. But when I get to 1,000,000 units, that same average fixed cost is irrelevant per unit. So the average fixed cost becomes less and less meaningful and less significant to overall average total cost as you get more output into the firm. So there's the average fixed cost curve right there, AFC. I've got one of the curves included. Now I'm going to put in, the next curve I'm going to put in is the famous marginal cost curve, the one that is the driving force. See, fixed costs actually kind of become irrelevant. As your output increases, your unit fixed cost becomes really not important at all. So as we go along in the course, you'll see me not even draw in the average fixed cost curve anymore because its impact is very big in low output levels, becomes irrelevant later. But the next one to put in is the big kahuna, the marginal cost curve, which we usually draw something like a J-hook. It actually can have a little bit of a dipping place in it in real life. But eventually that law of increasing marginal costs sinks its teeth in and never lets go. Marginal cost is a rapidly rising curve eventually. And so classically you'll see a marginal cost curve looks like a J-hook, rapidly rising eventually. Now, the next curve that I'm going to put in here is the average variable cost curve, which is based upon what I did over there. It's an arithmetic thing. It's just arithmetic. The average variable cost curve, when the average is above the last, the average has to be falling. And it will keep falling as long as the last unit costs less than the unit before. It will bottom out where this last is the same as the average. And then just like the arithmetic principle, it will begin to rise. When the last is above the average, it will rise. So there is the average variable cost curve. Its shape, where its location is, has to do with overall costs and considerations. But its shape is driven by the marginal cost curve. It will be falling. Your unit cost, average unit cost, will be falling as long as the last unit costs less than the average. And it will be rising when the last unit costs more than the average. That's the average variable cost curve. Now we've got one more curve to put in here, the average total cost curve. Now if you look at every unit level of output, the average total cost would be the average fixed cost, how high up your fixed cost is, plus your average variable cost for that unit. So that would be that number right there plus that number right there. So at low output levels, the average total cost curve would be way, way high, your average cost, total cost, overall cost, because you've got such a massive amount of unit fixed cost involved. But as time goes on, the unit cost that's fixed becomes tiny. So ultimately, eventually, the average total cost curve begins to converge on the average variable cost curve. Because, see, look out here. See at this unit of output right here? See how the fixed cost part of that unit, average fixed cost, is really tiny. So the overall total cost of that unit would be pretty much just entirely the average variable cost. So if I were to draw in the average total cost curve, it would start out way above the average variable cost curve because that average fixed cost is just walloping it. Now, eventually, it actually drops very rapidly for quite a while because your average fixed cost is losing its punch as part of the overall average cost. Now, interestingly, it will behave like the other average cost curve. It will bottom out at marginal cost, just like this guy did, and then it will start to rise. And it will get closer and closer to being nothing but the average variable cost curve. So the ATC curve has very much the same shape on the outbound leg as the average variable cost curve. It just starts out much higher because of those unit fixed costs that are just so huge when you're starting out a business. Those are the four cost curves of the firm, what they look like. They have all, each of them has a very characteristic shape to it. The marginal cost curve looks like a J-hook. The average fixed cost is one side of a hyperbola. And then these two average variable cost, average total cost curves, they have this very characteristic shape too. On the exam, I'm going to give you a picture of four curves just with like 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to say, tell me which one's which. That's all I'm going to do. That's four questions that are so easy that you'll get 8 points on the exam. Mom can put it up on the fridge. It's really that easy. Okay, or maybe not. Okay, but I want to point out a couple of real subtle nuances. Write this down, and you have to think about it and look at it for a while. I'm going to ask a couple of questions. On the exam, you're probably going to have maybe like you'll have four questions just on identifying the curves. Then you'll have some more questions about marginal costs and all that kind of stuff. I might say one where I'd say if marginal cost is below average variable cost, what's happening to average variable cost? Average variable cost is falling, average variable cost is rising. You know, those kinds of questions are pretty standard. So you'll have a couple of those. Then I'll hit you with a couple of subtle ones where you have to think about the curves themselves and their relationship. I want you to notice something. Let me ask it this way. If average variable cost is falling, is it true that average fixed cost is if average variable cost is falling, is it categorically true that average total cost is falling too? Let me write it down. If average variable cost is falling, then average total cost must be falling too. Is that true or false? Again, if average variable cost is falling, then average total cost must be falling too. Is that always true, or I can't say that's true all the time? Okay, all I can see, well, average variable cost, see, when I look at the average variable cost falling, I see falling. So right off the top of your head, you'd say, yeah, that's true. But look closely. Average variable cost is falling. It stops falling here. Average variable cost is falling. Okay? So it stops falling here. Yeah, average total cost is always falling. If average variable cost is falling, then you are no doubt in the part of average total cost that's falling. So that would be a true statement right there. Now let's take the other side of that. If average total cost is falling, then average variable cost must be falling too. A, true. B, false. Again, if average total cost is falling, then average variable cost must be falling too. Okay, look at average total cost. Falling, 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 falling. Okay, see, it keeps falling up to that output level right there. See that? Oh, wait a minute. There's a part of average total cost. There's an output range where average total cost is still falling, but average variable cost has already started kicking upward and is rising. In economic terms, talk about it in terms of a firm's costs, there's a point where you start suffering. The marginal cost curve is being driven. I'm sorry, the average variable cost is being driven only by marginal cost. There's a place where that marginal cost curve sinks its teeth into your average variable cost and starts pulling it upward. But there's that range where the average fixed cost is still falling, and that keeps the average total cost falling for a while. So this guy right here, this thing is false. Because there is a range of outputs from here to here about where the average total cost is still falling because average fixed cost is falling. But the average variable cost has already started its march upward. That one's subtler. You have to look at it, and you have to be able to draw the curves very carefully to see it. But sure enough, these two are not symmetric statements. One's true, the other's false. Watch that. I'll ask something about that on the exam. somehow I will ask that for you to see, show me that you know that concept on exam one. You got the idea of it? It's not that, it's not, after a while you get the hang of it, but boy, you have to draw these curves. When you're drawing these curves yourself, you have to draw them very carefully to catch the nuance that's happening in there. Now, on the exam, one of the good things for the exam will be, though, that, you know, you will already, you'll have the pictures of them. So you've done properly. So that will help you out a lot here. There's one other thing to bring up in all of this. Marginal cost drives our decision making, because if I can't sell the last unit for as much as it costs to make it, I'm not going to make that last unit. I'll back down to a point where my marginal cost is lower. But I did want to bring up one minor point here. And I might have brought this up before, but I just want to emphasize this because I do ask something about this on the exam. Let me draw you real, just for us, maybe about 5 minutes, into the long run. Everything we do in economics to analyze the short-run behavior of firms has to do with the short run, where only one factor of production is variable. The thing of it, though, is that the long run does come to bear. Now, the company can't make decision-making for the long run, but industries do have, we see what an industry's long-run profile is over a long-run period of time. Every company is acting in the short run, but you see the long run show up. When I draw these cost curves, the reality is that companies that are big estimate their whole cost curve structure. But for the typical company, they're not going to see all of these curves that I drew for you. They're just not going to see them. They're going to see maybe a few data points for a few different output levels that they do. They've produced here, here, here in a short-run situation. And they'll get some data points on marginal cost, average variable cost, average total cost, and their average fixed cost curve. They'll get, for different output levels, they'll see sort of something like what their short-run cost structure looks like. But then they will shift to a new cost curve structure because they've changed another factor of production. So for the short run, while we were working with this amount of labor, we varied the labor, nothing else changed. Oh, well, now we've moved to a new factory. That would actually change the entire cost structure, and they'd have to be on another cost curve. So over a long period of time, what is happening with a company if I drew long run quantity and long run cost? Over a long period of time, the company, though it didn't know it, would be moving along a set of short run cost curves. Now I'm going to draw in the average total cost curve. It would spend a little bit of time with the marginal cost and average variable cost, average total cost, average fixed cost on one curve. Then it would change more than one factor of production. And then it would move to a new cost curve. And then it would move to a new one over after a while. It'd buy a new truck fleet, maybe. It would buy new factory. It would move to a new factory. And so in each case, what would be happening is it would be shifting to a new set of cost curves, the cost curves that I draw for you. And like I said, it would never really be that long on any given short-run cost curve that it could fully map out. Like I said, there's mathematics and productions operations management jockeys that can work out what the total thing looked like at any given place in time. But over a period of time, as the long run bites, you would have more than one factor of production changing. And so the total cost curve and all the cost curves would be moving. What we see in the real world and theoretically is, just like many processes in nature, what looked like just pure decision-making, free will of management and board of directors of a company was existing within what we call in mathematics an envelope. All of those cost curves that were showing up that the firm was dealing with in the short run were actually resting along a long run average cost curve that the firm never saw. No matter how efficient they got in any short run situation, those cost curves never went below some invisible to the company long-run average cost curve. Now, I don't write long-run average total cost curve, long-run average variable cost curve, because there's no distinction. In the long run, all your costs are variable. And although the company never actually saw this long-run average cost curve, no matter what they did, no matter how efficient they got in any short-run situation, they were always parked on that long-run average cost curve, moving along it. Now, real world. These long-run average cost curves have all kinds of looks. We can look at them from the outside, looking back through industrial history and all that. But they all generically, we can say, there's sort of like this basic overall shape. And I'm drawing it like a U with a kind of like a flat bottom, where output level first, and this is long run, the unit cost was falling. For the output levels where the unit cost was falling, from 0 units of production up to Q1, and again long run, the unit cost, the cost, average cost per unit, was falling. We call that the region where the company was realizing economies of scale, or scale economies. You'll hear me say it that way sometimes. Economies of scale. Now, the company might or might not have seen this itself, but this long-run average cost per unit that the company was producing was falling. So there would be a lot of incentive for the company to grow. Now, it was growing for short-run reasons, but on a long-term basis, it was growing because the unit cost was going down. Then there's this place that we'll see where, quite often, from production Q1 to Q2, where the average unit cost really doesn't go down, but it doesn't go up either. We say that this is, in the long run, the region of output where the company is realizing constant returns to scale. It's not lowering long-run costs at all, but it's not realizing higher long-run costs at all. And then eventually, and it's all dependent upon the industry and all of that, really, there comes a point where pretty much all firms, not all, but almost all firms, begin to realize diseconomies of scale. In other words, the long run average cost is rising. Diseconomies of scale. Long run average costs are rising. Now let me tell you a couple of things about this. First things first, the place where your long-run average cost bottoms out, we have a name for that because it's actually we see in the long run, that's like an equilibrium where industries, companies seem to kind of find their way to it in the long run. In this graph, that's Q1. It's called the minimum efficient scale of output. It's a place where the long run unit cost will not go ever any lower. And like I said, although companies wouldn't see it themselves, we do see over a long period of time industries tending to kind of land there. There, for you know, you might see for years the industry is growing. Then you might see periods of time where the output is larger than this minimum efficient scale of output or operations. Sometimes we call it minimum efficient scale of operations. But it tends to locate sort of like a metastable node around that value right there. But like I said, you can see it happen all over the place. Now, I want to point out something about that minimum efficient scale of operations. We don't see companies in the short run at it. We just don't. If you were to be within a company, and I go to companies all the time, I take my students up to see the big companies in Chicago, down in St. Louis, and these companies talk about grow, and all that kind of stuff. And what they're doing is they're saying, okay, well, at any given short run situation, we just have to keep growing. The interesting thing, though, is that that short-run decision-making process can be completely wrong for the long run. Look at this company right here. Its incentive is to just keep growing, working its way along cost curves. So look at it, the company might be way out here on a short-run average cost curve producing this output right here. Okay? Now, the first thing the company's going to do is say efficiency. We've got to bring our costs down. So the way they're going to bring their costs down is not to ride down the long-run average cost curve. They don't see the long run. They see their short-run cost curve. So their short-run behavior would be, we need to cut our costs. How do they do that? They push output upward. They lay off workers. They cut benefits. They reduce the number of paper clips you're allowed to use. See how they're going to drive to a larger output, that short-run logical, rational behavior. But from the perspective of the long run, they should be backing off output. But that's not what they'll do. They'll grow, they'll cut costs, they'll lay off workers, one of the big popular things. Well, we cut costs by laying off people. And Wall Street rewards them with higher stock prices and all that kind of great stuff every time. They're driving this way when they should be driving for the long run the other way. But you tell them, well, the way you reduce your costs, you've got to stop producing so much. Wait, what? Yes. You get rid of some of your factories and all that kind of stuff. That's how you reduce your costs. No. If we just lay off 2,500 workers, our costs will be lower. Sure enough, they will. But you're actually pushing your long-run average cost that way, doing it. It's a persistent problem, and it will never go away. That the long-run behavior that is optimal from an industrial point of view will never be the behavior that the companies do in the short run. You can't tell them to do it. It just isn't the way they'll do it. Here's something, one last thing, just last little point. I brought this up. This actually connects to a lecture long ago. Why do different industries have different numbers of companies? You'll see some industries where there are two or three or four companies, other industries where there are literally hundreds of thousands. Look how many pizza joints are in this town, how many restaurants are in this town. But at the same time, look how many auto manufacturers there are globally. incredibly different scales of operation. The explanation that is the best for that is because of completely different long-run average cost curve structures. This would be an LRAC of, let's say, restaurants. Very high, very minimum efficient scale of operations at a very low output level. Let's say that the consumer universe for this good is way out here at Q star. You're going to see a lot of companies. See, because over a long period of time, even though they won't think this way, over a long period of time, the survivorship would tend toward each of the companies that were long-term survivors, each producing not very much output. And so you would see an industry like that with many, many, many companies in it. A lot of fierce competition. But suppose that that same consumer universe was the one for another type of industry entirely, where you had long-run economies of scale and your minimum efficient scale of operation for a single company was at a fairly substantial amount of the output level of the need of the consumers. In an industry like that, you would see only a few companies hanging around. You also would see maybe too many companies sometimes, and then one would fall apart, and then there wouldn't be enough. So you could see two very different levels of competition satisfying the same consumer universe for different goods simply because of what the long-run average cost structures of these different industries was. This principle, as it was brought up some years ago by an economist named Friedman, is called the survivorship principle. Competitive nature of an industry is driven in the long run by things that are beyond the companies themselves, than just the nature of the products they make, how long economies of scale hold on before they go away. There's one kind of industry. Now, there are some who argue that these actually don't exist, but they really do. It's a very unusual animal, but it's also a very disturbing animal. It's an industry where the long-run average cost curve never stops falling. Essentially, no matter how big the company gets, its long-run average cost just keeps going down. It has permanent economies of scale. The bigger it gets, the lower the average cost per unit. This has a very odd little implication to it. You remember how when I just finished drawing those long-run average cost curves, I'm sorry, short-run cost curves, marginal cost, average cost bottoms out, marginal cost and average cost hit each other at the bottom of the average cost curve. Okay, we got an average cost curve here. We know that the marginal cost curve crosses the average cost curve at the bottom of the average cost curve. See, bottom is where the marginal cost curve crosses the average cost curve. Okay, so I'm going to try to draw in a marginal cost curve for this oddball right here. I want you to tell me where I take the marginal cost curve. This red curve is the marginal cost curve. Where do I turn it up so that it can cross the average cost curve? Remember, it's got to cross the average cost curve at the bottom of the average cost curve. So where do I turn this marginal cost curve up so that it crosses?
It's an asymptote.
It will never cross it because the average cost curve never bottoms out. The marginal cost curve cannot cross it. With this kind of, in other words, what I'm saying here is that this marginal cost curve of what we call a natural monopoly approaches zero. The cost of the last unit gets to the point where it's almost zero. Think about it. How much does it cost Verizon really to turn on your phone service? Aren't we the most generous sons of bitches on earth? We're going to waive your switch-on fee. There isn't a switch-on fee. There's no cost to them of it. Really. The marginal cost, the cost of producing one more unit, is virtually zero in a natural monopoly. Well, that's kind of an odd thing. With these kinds of companies, the bigger they get, the less it costs them per unit to produce a product, to the point where the last unit they produce is virtually zero in cost. There's still massive fixed costs, no question about that, but the cost of providing one more unit is virtually zero. Now, do you happen to remember when I told you about a kind of good where the cost of one more user is zero? Do you remember what I called that good? It was when I was talking about externalities, and I kind of threw that one in there. It's called a public good. Remember, public goods are goods for which the cost of one more user is zero. Natural monopolies are producing almost public goods. The cost of one more user is virtually zero, which means that basically the marginal cost concept is no longer applicable to pricing in these kinds of companies. You can't price based on marginal cost, because there is no marginal cost, no extra cost to one more user of the service. Cell phone companies, the reason they're merging back together again is because there is a natural monopoly that is embedded in the long-run cost. Yeah. A large bank? Well, the problem there is that probably they don't have natural monopoly status, because they have to just keep building more and more machinery to handle the larger and larger volume and complexity of transactions that they do. Possibly. It's hard to call, though. The one, no doubt about it, though, is that these natural monopolies, although some very, very conservative economists say, well, even if they do exist, it's okay. But the problem is that once you get to the point where you're talking about public goods, you're talking about things that, at large, large scale, only governments normally would be providing. Now, there are public goods, as I said, that are provided by the private sector. Generally speaking, those can be a problem, but at the same time, they are out there. But when you get to scales of this size of cell phone companies, the size of a Microsoft, the size of a Facebook, the size that we're talking about here, you're talking about things that are being provided by private sector, with private sector profit maximization considerations, that normally, historically, are provided by governments, by sovereigns, which would explain why, back a couple of years, back after 9/11, there was such a concern about terrorists in the United States that an illegal activity was engaged by the United States government. A large facility was built out on the West Coast that would monitor every cell phone call, every telephone call, and every email everyone was making in the United States, collect the data to try to capture terrorists. It was illegal. You can't do that. And finally, but all of the cell phone companies agreed to join in it, except for one, QWest. QWest, interestingly enough, its CEO, several years later, was prosecuted successfully for securities fraud, and he is now in prison. Isn't that interesting? But all the other, the big companies, Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, they all said, okay, you can watch everyone's cell phone calls, listen in on everyone, no warrant needed. And this was just an absolute outrage. The guy who actually turned on the switch to make the system work was the one who squealed, a whistleblower. He actually lives in fear of his life to this day because he blew the whistle on this illegal thing that was being done. But it was caught. They were outed after they collected years of data, which still is there. And then in 2006, 2007, consumer groups started saying, all right, we're going to sue. the government is not going to prosecute the companies because the companies were doing what the government said to do, but it was still illegal. So consumer groups started suing the hell out of the cell phone companies that were involved in this. Those cell phone companies had already started merging into a larger and larger entity, a couple of large entities by then. And so in 2007, early 2008, a law was passed by the United States government forbidding anyone from suing those companies. That's what's called sovereign immunity. You see, you're not allowed to sue the government. Sovereign immunity means that the government, the king, is above suit, unless the king says you can sue me. So this law that was passed in 2007 essentially gave the status of the sovereign to the cell phone companies that had done what the sovereign wanted. Essentially, a merger of private sector profit-maximizing companies with the United States government so that they had the same status, protected from lawsuit, as the government itself does. We don't see that too often in history, in modern history. One example that we have was from the late 1930s in the government that was running Germany, called the Third Reich. It's generically called the Third Reich. There was a massive industrial complex run by a family called the Krupp dynasty. They built all the war machinery. They used slave labor. It was just a massive operation. The Reichstag under the Führer, Adolf Hitler, passed a law at the time called Lex Krupp, the law of the Krupps, giving them the same sovereign immunity that we did in 2008 to the cell phone companies. The same idea, protecting those that do the sovereign's will by making them part of the sovereign and having all the benefits of the sovereign. That's the danger of these public goods in the private sector. Companies that large, they can literally get by with whatever they want because they are the government. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.